Marshall and Sagar here. Welcome back to The Realignment. This week, Sagar and I went back to Capitol Hill, where we interviewed Arkansas Senator Tom Cotton. We actually recorded the episode in his Senate office, which was really nicely upholstered. So if you want to see a change of scenery from our infamous couch, you can check out Hudson's YouTube page to see what we're doing. We cover a lot of ground on this episode. We start off with the coronavirus outbreak and the controversy over the virus's origins. We go on to the broader debate about how the United States should engage with the Chinese Communist Party, everything from the trade war to negotiations to actual military engagement. And finally, we really dive into the case for American global leadership with Senator Cotton at a time when people in both parties are skeptical of the wars and the conflicts the United States is engaged in. With all that, let's dive in.
Senator Cotton, thanks so much for joining The Realignment. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, my pleasure. It's good to be on.
Thanks for coming.
So, Senator, as we're speaking right now, there's this virus that's plaguing China. We have remaining questions as to how much we can trust the CCP and their information. But the way I want to talk about this with you is about how it's revealed some major deficiencies in the U.S. supply chain. What do you think it is about this incident in particular that has showed shortages just in the medical industry and how that applies across the U.S. economy writ large?
Well, the short answer to your first question is you cannot trust the Chinese Communist Party. About 6 weeks since the public revelation of this coronavirus, they are still obfuscating the origins of it and probably the full extent of it in China as well. So we don't know, for instance, yet what the reproduction rate will be, how many persons one infected person could then infect, or what the mortality rate will be. We don't know the origins yet because we do know that it didn't originate in that food market. Those are all examples of how the Chinese Communist Party is still not being transparent, trying to save face and protect themselves and their own economy. But as you say, it also reveals some vulnerabilities to the U.S. economy, specifically in our supply chains, because so much production in our supply chains, to include, regrettably, pharmaceutical and medical goods, are often starting in China. There was a time in late January when I was advocating that we halt all travel from China when there were genuine concerns, which I understood, although I thought the public safety considerations outweighed them, that if we halted, say, cargo shipping and cargo flights from China, it could have a significantly negative impact on our economy. I'd say at this point, it's probably going to have some negative impact on our economy, if only because the very beginning of those supply chains, not the chains themselves, might have ground to a halt as well. If those factories that produce precursors for our generic drugs, for instance, or basic medical supplies, ironically, some of which are necessary to arrest the spread of coronavirus, the chain doesn't really matter anymore if there's no goods being fed into them. I think it's just another time to step back and reconsider the degree to which we've allowed China to integrate into our economy, being not a partner, not a friend, but a competitor, a rival, even an adversary. And I think it's going to accelerate what you've seen for economic and political reasons over the last 3 years, more companies trying to diversify their supply chains outside of China.
Yeah.
So it's now conventional wisdom that we've mismanaged our relationship with China. Now, moving forward, though, what do you think the implications are of, you know, the inability to trust them as a partner? How should people be approaching this issue then?
Yeah, so I would say that the U.S. government made a lot of mistakes with China over the last 20 to 25 years. At a point, though, you could have considered it an experiment, the way we approached China. And that would have been probably after the opening up of Deng Xiaoping through the 1980s. I think we should have been much more forceful in our response to Tiananmen Square. But even after that, in the 1990s, when China was still a relatively small and weak economy that wasn't fully integrated with ours or the West, there was an effort to then bring them into the World Trade Organization, treat them as a normal trading partner, not a mercantilist nation, which they are. And the predictions in both parties in Washington and among the so-called experts in economics and finance is that, oh, as China becomes more market-driven, as they have more of a capitalist economy, socialism with Chinese characteristics as Ding Wen said, they would also become more democratic in their politics. They would allow more freedom of speech, freedom of religion. You'd start to see elections at the local level, moving up to the district, the provincial level, and so forth. And the Chinese Communist Party would be less autocratic, less authoritarian. I understand the theory behind that logic, and in fact, it has worked in some societies, some East Asian societies, as a matter of fact. But again, it was an experiment, and it clearly failed by the mid-2000s, and it certainly failed in the aftermath of the housing collapse in 2008 and 2009. So we should have called a halt to that experiment and begin to reverse some of its effects, because where we stand with China today is not, you know, a necessity of the inherent logic of events. It's a result of active policy choices that mm-hmm. people in Washington have made, that businesses in America have made, and that has been very deliberate by Beijing. So it's time to start reconsidering those choices. And the president has done a lot of those. Your podcast is called The Realignment, and he's helped realign a lot of thinking about China, especially on trade. And I have to say, in our party, in no small part, too many Republicans for too long bought into this idea that China was going to become more democratic, more market-based, and you know, follow the international rules of the road, despite all the evidence we saw.
Right.
The Democrats, in many cases, have actually been there for a long time. If you look at someone like Chuck Schumer, mm-hmm. who likes to claim how he's been tougher on China for longer than anyone in Congress. And it's in part because he's been here longer than I've been alive.
Math.
But it is true that a lot of Democrats had a well-taken perspective on China, especially on the trade issue, putting aside security right. and military and intelligence matters, in which Democrats tend to be, in my opinion, a little naive about China. But it certainly has led to a shift of opinion among Republican leaders in Washington to where I and Republican voters have been for a pretty long time, is that China is not our friend or ally. They right. are a partner, they're a competitor, and an adversary.
That story you told, it's now largely taken with the GOP. The question now is, how do we have that trading relationship with China? I've seen speculation all the way from the range of, we should bifurcate the U.S. and Chinese economies, to we should accommodate to somewhere around where the president is, maybe even a little bit less. Where do you find yourself in there, and how have you thought about it?
So our relationship with China is very different than it ever was with the Soviet Union. And I'm not saying that we have to have a Cold War with China, but the lack of economic and financial ties between the Soviet Union, between the Warsaw Pact nations more broadly, and the West gave them less leverage over Western policy, and especially U.S. policy. And we need to think through those implications. You've seen it, for instance, in the way that China puts propaganda in the Washington Post or the New York Times, or they tried to intimidate the NBA into punishing someone for simply saying that Hong Kongers should be allowed to protest. If we are to have an economic relationship with China, we need to have one that does not compromise not only our security and our economic well-being, but the rights of our citizens too. So obviously there should be no trade in core military or security matters. And there's not a lot of that. There's a little bit more than I would like, but there's not much. A major area for retrenchment, though, is dual-use technology. And the administration, especially the Department of Commerce, could do a much better job of policing the export of dual-use technology, or through the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States, the Chinese acquisition of dual-use technology. And here I'm talking about things like information technology, artificial intelligence, quantum computing, biotechnology, right. things that China has made very explicit is inherent in the way that they plan to grow and their way of war should they be compelled to make war in the future. We need to make sure that we are not underwriting the People's Liberation Army. Mm.
So what I like about what you're saying is that all of this precludes an assumption, or it includes an assumption, that the government can and should do something about this. This has been one of the great things about the realignment of 2016 within the conservative movement, is about the argument of government itself. And what you're saying is actually requiring a government intervention within the market. Now, you're famous within the conservative movement for having actually read many of the books that formed the conservative movement. As somebody who came up within that chain of professional conservative movement, which has very much trended towards the free market orthodoxy at all costs. How have you grappled with it and arrived at this position
today?
So
we should be clear that free trade between nations is an aspirational goal. It is not a natural condition for mankind. Trade agreements, although labeled free trade, are rarely, in fact, free trade agreements. They are highly technical, mm-hmm. highly complex, very carefully negotiated documents between countries at radically different levels of development and radically different regulatory regimes. That is especially true of a nation like China. Even when nations are relatively similar in terms of their level of development and the kind of regulatory the regimes they have, let's say the United States and Canada, there can still be some pretty tense negotiations as governments are looking for the best deal for their people, whether it's on, say, timber exports into Canada or dairy exports into Canada. But when you're dealing with a country like China, in which the median wage, though much higher than it once was, is still a fraction of what we have in the United States, when it's run by the Communist Party in a authoritarian, centralized fashion versus our free market capitalist economy, free trade is only an aspirational goal. So, of course, the government must have a significant role in trying to get the very best deals for Americans, not only as producers or as consumers, but also as citizens who are worried about the threat of a rival communist power in Asia with 1.4 billion people, with the express intent to replace us as not just the dominant power in East Asia, but the dominant global power in this century.
Yeah. So how do you think, so you cited how Democrats were thinking about trade in a way differently in the past, so everything from Senator Sherrod Brown to Senator Chuck Schumer. How do you think Democrats are going to approach this issue going forward? Because you obviously have persons like Michael Bloomberg who are very friendly to China on a couple of different levels. Yeah. How do you think that's going to shake out?
Yeah, so I mean, the Democratic Party still has some panda huggers among their ranks. Mike Bloomberg, probably first among them. I mean, Mr. Bloomberg has said that he does not think that China is a communist country and that Xi Jinping is responsive to domestic politics. And I guess, if you mean an uprising and revolt of the peasants that are oppressed by the Communist Party, sure, every government that is authoritarian ultimately could face that. But in the sense of any meaningful democratic check, it's actually gotten much worse mm-hmm. in the 30 years since Tiananmen Square. So if the Democrats nominate someone like that as their presidential candidate, I think it will be a major issue in our campaign. Because again, the Chinese Communist Party is not very high up on the list of organizations with favorable opinion among American people.
Right.
The American people know that the Chinese Communist Party has been cheating us of jobs and of wealth for decades, and they're building up their military specifically to counteract America's military might. So if the Democrats end up nominating someone who comes from, say, the Bloomberg wing of it on China as opposed to the Schumer wing on China, I think it's going to be a, if not the central issue in the campaign.
Yeah. So another issue, obviously, you're referencing China's global ambitions, and you really see this with Huawei and 5G technology. There's been some really disconcerting polls out there that show that many of our European allies and their populations either are in favor of sitting out any sort of competition economically, politically between the U.S. and China, but also in many ways favor Chinese integration. How should we approach that issue?
So European governments should not be integrating into China on things like 5G wireless technology. I was very disappointed with the United Kingdom's decision a couple weeks ago to try to use Chinese technology, but not quite use it, and say they could build a wall around it. Obviously, we're going to remain close allies with the United Kingdom, but we have some real risks that we'll have to mitigate there. These countries would be much better off, though, if they took the approach not only of the United States, but countries like Australia and Japan that have said, we recognize that we cannot guarantee the security of our information systems, mm-hmm. whether it's the way we trade our agricultural products or the way stocks are traded, or notably the way we communicate securely with our military forces, if we have Chinese technology in our system. Maybe it's secure, maybe it's not, but you never quite know, and you should err on the side of caution when dealing with the Chinese Communist Party. Now, that means that you got to find a reasonable alternative that mm-hmm. can be, done at a reasonable price. Right now, it's mostly European technology, Nokia and Ericsson. But that may mean that the governments have to pay a little bit more, mm-hmm. or that they have to develop a strategy for 5G rollouts that are going to cost taxpayers in those countries a little bit more. I think that's a reasonable cost for most countries to pay in return for the what they get on security. Just like most Arkansans I know are perfectly willing for their tax dollars to go towards fifth generation stealth fighters, they want their tax dollars to go towards a secure and secure fifth generation wireless system that protects their privacy and protects our nation's security.
So the question is now that the UK has done this, is that to me the only policy option is to either let them go forward or increase the cost to them relative to the benefit they're getting to the Chinese. How do we look at that broadly in terms of our relationship with Europe, as we really are in a power struggle with Chinese economic entanglements in their economies, who are not, frankly, as upset or even, you know, even close to having the level of alarm, despite much deeper levels of integration than we have here in the U.S. As U.S. policymakers, what is in our toolkit, or specifically in your toolkit, in trying to deal with a country like the United Kingdom?
We're always going to have that close relationship with the United Kingdom. You know, they're part of the so-called Five Eyes intelligence sharing partnership. I hope their decision to use Huawei technology to a degree doesn't impair that relationship. I know the administration is working closely with the government in London to try to mitigate that risk, but they have to know that we're going to do what's necessary to protect our intelligence sources and methods and not compromise our information technology systems. Likewise, all the continental countries in Europe who haven't yet made this decision should not make the decision. I understand that many of them want to have a trading relationship with China, and there are some things that they can do that don't really imperil any of our interests, but any European nation that goes down the path of building out 5G technology across which NATO communications may move needs to know that there'll be consequences if they build Huawei technology into
right.
their systems.
As there should, I think.
So something you mentioned earlier was we had a failed response to Tiananmen Square. So today we've had two sort of events happening. Obviously the extensive Hong Kong protests, but also the rebuke at the polls in Taiwan over sort of forces that are more interested in integrating the two countries together. So how should we be approaching this moment going forward?
Well, I think it's a very fraught moment for Xi Jinping and the Chinese Communist Party, but especially for Chairman Xi, since he has consolidated powers in his hands to an extent not seen, and certainly Deng Xiaoping and maybe Mao Zedong. I mean, he cited a couple things. Obviously, the Wuhan coronavirus and the re-election of Tsai Ing-wen in Taiwan, but also consider now months-long protests in Hong Kong against a unjust and unconstitutional extradition bill that was going to allow mainland China to steal Hong Kong protesters away in the middle of the night and take them to gulags in China. Consider, too, the concentration camps they have of religious minorities up in their northwest province of Xinjiang. There was a major and significant leak of information about those camps to the New York Times. Presumably that had to come from someone inside the Chinese Communist Party that was displeased with Xi Jinping. The Phase One trade deal benefits America more than it does China. China still faces a significant number of tariffs. You can see that by looking at Chinese-controlled media. They have not really focused on that trade deal much at all. So Xi Jinping faces a significant number of challenges right now that really calls into question the wisdom of the steps he's taken over the last 8 years to move away from a more kind of rule by consensus of party elders into one-man Mao rule. I don't know how that's going to turn out for him. And I imagine there's a lot of friction right now in Beijing, given all these multiplying crises, in particular capped off by the Wuhan coronavirus, which could cause China's economy to contract for the first time in a generation.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. I think the last thing we want to focus on really with you is generally is foreign policy writ large within the realignment. This is something that there's been quite a bit, there's a spectrum that I think in the post-Trump era on the right, which is that there are some who are leaning very far into almost an isolationism of let's cut the military, let's bring our troops home. Then there are others who are saying let's reorient from the Middle East to Asia. I'm not actually sure where you would put yourself within that. And I think that's what's so fascinating about the China question is it forces us to ask real questions about the strategic posture of our military today and where it should go. Do you think we should reorient or can we keep where we are right now and tackle and have a comprehensive strategy of the Chinese at the same time?
Well, so if you're the global superpower, as we are and we have been for a century, you have to have global concerns. There's no doubt, as we've said, the biggest risk to our security, to our prosperity is China. That's one reason why we're building up more maritime and air forces, in large part because if you just look at the map, the threat from China is probably going to be primarily an air and naval threat. However, our interests in the Middle East are still significant, whether it's defending our allies, countries like Israel, the only democracy in the Middle East, or ensuring that although we don't use that much Middle Eastern oil anymore, that our trading partners around the world do can right. still have access to that. And finally, making sure that you don't have a rogue nation like Iran that is developing not just nuclear weapons, but ballistic missiles that can imperil all those threats. Mm-hmm. Europe is still a very important theater. The risk in Europe is Russia primarily. Russia is still a significant world power in no small part because of their nuclear weapons mm-hmm. and their skillful intelligence services that go back not just to the Soviet Union, but to the old Tsarist era. They're primarily a threat in Europe, though. Europeans need to do a better job of counteracting that Russian threat. And that's not just a military threat, although they need to keep spending more on their military and be better integrated at the level of NATO. That's also an economic threat. So that's why it's so disappointing to see a country like Germany trying to cut its own deal with Russia to make itself more dependent on Russian gas, while Eastern European countries are held hostage to that Russia-German alliance. So we have global interests, and we have to have a global focus, but we have to always remember that China is the rising power. Russia is a stagnant or declining power. The other threats we face are primarily rogue nations mm-hmm. like Iran or subnational actors like Al-Qaeda or right. ISIS. But we have to keep in mind that the top priority in the years ahead, probably in the century ahead, will be China.
So my last bit is, we're obviously avoiding the use of the term a new Cold War, but I think a more apt term would be great power competition. So what would your parting message be for persons who are in the business community, who, for example, just saw China as, hey, it's a market for shoes, it's a market for movies, and then aren't seeing it in that foreign policy context? For tech companies who are, you know, having internal revolts of staff who have a problem working with ICE or with the military but don't have a problem with China, how should they be thinking about this new era?
So one key message I would send to the business community, really to all Americans when you think about China, is remember to distinguish between China in terms of its people and the Chinese Communist Party. For instance, the Chinese Communist Party and some on the left in America have criticized what they perceive as an overreaction to the Wuhan coronavirus, saying it's driven in part by racism. Mm-hmm. That's ridiculous, because the Chinese people are the first and the worst victims of the Chinese Communist Party's incompetence and duplicity and lack of transparency. The same is true for an economic matter as well, though. China could be a great market for Americans. It could be even bigger than it is now. It could be well integrated into our supply chains if the Chinese Communist Party changed its stripes. Mm-hmm. If they truly did what many in the world thought they might do 25 years ago. But as long as the Chinese Communist Party continues to tighten its authoritarian grip on power, and in particular, as long as Xi Jinping continues to exert more power and control over that government and its people than any dictator since Mao Zedong, then I think most persons in business should be pretty leery mm-hmm. about integrating any further with China, and should start thinking about the many opportunities they have all around the globe to build and ship products from other places, even maybe right back here in the United States of America.
Well, hopefully. So last question for you here, sir. One of the things we see in the rise of the Democratic candidates is almost an embrace or a want of a multipolar U.S. system, of a shirking of the superpower, because they take a frame that a superpower status of the United States is implicitly harmful to the other world. I mean, I think I have, and the posture of this podcast really is that a world in which America retreats is in a world in which China rises and makes us all less free. But maybe make that case for some of our listeners.
So look, the simplest rule.
And to add one thing to that too, people also say that superpower status leads to endless wars.
Right.
That's sort of trope.
Yeah. The simplest and oldest rule of international politics is you run the show or the show runs you. And for almost a century, certainly for the last 75 years, the United States has been able to run the show. I understand there are a lot of anti-American voices on the left who blame America first for every problem around the world and think that the world would be a better place if America were less involved in it, that we should be more like the world rather than the world being more like America. I fundamentally reject that idea, and the vast majority of Americans do as well. They want the power, the economic power, the military power, to be able to run the show. That doesn't mean that we're going to be the world's policeman. It doesn't mean that we're going to be able to bring democracy to lands that has never prospered before. But it does mean that we'll have the power that's necessary to defend the interests of the American people all around the world from an economic standpoint and from a security standpoint. And hopefully, this is part of the reason why you have a dominant military, a dominant economy, is that you don't have to use that power to begin with. It is a latent power that all of our adversaries recognize around the world, and they understand there's no point even challenging the American military. There's no point in trying to displace the dollar as the world's reserve currency. There's no point in trying to beat us in trade deals because we have so much latent power to bring to bear that we can crush any adversary that attempts to do so, whether it's on the field of battle or whether it's in the marketplace.
There you go. Well, thank you so much for joining us, sir. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank y'all.
Thanks for joining us. If you enjoyed the episode, please share the realignment with a friend and give us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or anywhere else you listen. We'll be back next week on Super Tuesday with Jane Costin of Vox, where she co-hosts the Weeds podcast. We go into a lot with Jane. She covers the right from the perspective of the left, so it's a really cool experience sort of debating how she's interpreting the political realignment of both parties, despite the fact that we're sort of on different ends of the aisle. So looking forward to that. We'll see you next week.